Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 17th, 2013. Debt. It's the stuff of nightmares. It can destroy your marriage, your health, your life. Well, wait a second. Debt also keeps a roof over the head of most homeowners, allows millions to get a college education, and paying it back can be a life-changing, empowering experience. Debt is a two-headed monster, and it's our topic this hour. A little later, we'll hear from a debt collector, also a story of digging out of debt, and we have some advice for Marketplace listeners struggling to pay back their student loans. First, though, this week brought some bright news about an uptick in consumer spending, something which might or might not mean a corresponding rise in credit card debt. And we're hoping Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith can sort this out for us. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Barbara.
So I just said an uptick. How much more are people spending here in the U.S.?
Well, we got some news that retail sales rose 0.1% in April. That was good news, especially after a decline that we saw in March. So we are back in stores again, but Chris Christopher, an economist with IHS Global Insights, said this might be a little deceptively positive. He said Americans have been scrimping for months because of worries about the fiscal cliff and other things.
It looks like the consumer is doing relatively well. However, a word of caution, it's not like they're opening up the champagne bottles and splurging everywhere. It's very targeted type of spending.
So targeted spending, what kinds of things are people buying?
Well, that was really interesting. We're actually spending less on the necessities. We spent less on gas. Of course, gas prices are down. We spent less in the grocery store, but we did spend more on our kind of splurgy things. We spent more on restaurants. We bought some bigger ticket items, a lot of home improvement type things, a lot of kind of big appliances. We were spending, but definitely not just on the bare necessities. We were spending a little bit more.
Well, our show today is about debt and credit. So can you tell if people are using plastic for these purchases?
Well, you'd think so because a lot of these purchases were bigger. But according to Chris Christopher from IHS Global Insight, that wasn't the case.
What is bought on credit is a little bit on the auto side. However, revolving credit, you know, credit card debt, for the most part has been relatively flat for the few years. In no way are we returning to our old ways anytime soon.
Christopher did say as the housing market starts to improve, we might see more credit spending because when people buy a house or rent a house, they tend to start spending money on things like washing machines and dryers and dishwashers and sort of other big purchases.
Well, this is just anecdotal on my part. I've been noticing that I've been cutting back for quite a while, but I recently, on the spur of the moment, decided to take an extra trip to New York, and I think I just felt a little hopeful about the economy again. Is that what we're seeing, perhaps, in these numbers, or am I just fooling myself?
No, that's a really good point. A lot of people are feeling that way. Chris Christopher from IHS Global Insight made that point as well. The job situation is starting to improve. We're seeing some improvements in the housing market. Things in the stock market is obviously doing really, really well right now. There do seem to be some signs that maybe there is a light at the end of the tunnel and our economic recovery is sort of moving along.
It's interesting, though. You're cutting the difference between some things cost less and people are also buying a little bit more. But it seems as if they're investing in things that, you know, if it's Home Depot price purchases, they're investing in something that will add value to their home. So they're thinking about what they're buying.
Well, yes, that's true. And I mean, the other thing to remember is that our wages haven't gone up. Our wages have stayed flat. So as prices have gone down, a lot of this increase has to do with the fact we have a little extra spending money because things like gas prices are cheaper. Some food prices have come down. So a lot of the extra spending that we're doing on bigger ticket items, you're right, they're home investments. They're things maybe people have been saving up for, thinking about for a while. And what will probably prevent us from higher spending is that, in fact, you know, wages have been flat for a long time.
Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith. Well, thanks so much for this.
Thank you, Barbara.
When you're in debt, your phone becomes the enemy. Every time it rings, your stomach lurches. Is it another bill collector? Will they get nasty? Happily, the Federal Trade Commission has done a lot in recent years to regulate those conversations and protect consumers from humiliation or harassment. But still, you never know what to expect when that dreaded call comes. So we decided to turn to someone in the industry to find out.
My name is Jack Brown. I'm a debt collector with Gulf Coast Collection Bureau in Sarasota, Florida. I'm a second-generation agency owner. My dad had a lot of great advice for me as my mentor in my business career, and it always started out with doing the right thing. I remember my first debt collection call was to a lady in Tampa, Florida, who had just had her leg amputated at the hospital due to a serious accident. Not only did she have a medical bill that she needed to deal with, but at the same time, the medical issues surrounding the account were still affecting her everyday life, and there was substantial financial implications along with that injury as well. So we not only had to find a solution for the account at hand, but she also needed some assistance with some of her other just daily tasks and how she was going to be able to work in order to support not just this past debt that she had incurred, but her bills on a monthly basis. We were able to find her some resources to get her on the right track going forward. It always bothers a debt collector when there's a consumer in a bad position, financial position, medical position, or whatever it is. If the consumer is going through a hard time and they're down on their luck, it can be concerning to the debt collector. However, the debt collector can then use that as an opportunity to help that person find a path out of their debt. The consumer may think there's no hope, no way to get out. Each and every account that we work on provides that consumer with some education and some resources if they should ever get into this situation again. We many times get thank you letters, letters of acknowledgement from the consumers. The perception of debt collectors is that there's a bunch of pit bulls out there who will beat up consumers, talk to them rudely, yell at them, lie to them, do whatever they can to get a dollar out of them today. In any industry, there are bad apples, bad actors, and there's 99% of the folks out there that are doing the right thing. They are out there complying with the laws and they are working, but there is that 1% out there that, you know, may cause some issues. If you ever deal with that type of agency, go to AskDrDebt.com, get some information on what your rights are, what you can expect during a collection call, how you can get the calls to stop if they're not treating you in the right way. If you don't address the account, it's not going to get resolved. So the first step is to make sure that you do call that debt collector back, because they will continue to call in attempt to get a hold of the consumer. So it's very important that you pick up the phone and that you talk with the debt collector.
Jack Brown is president of Gulf Coast Collection Bureau in Sarasota, Florida. If you're living with unpaid debts, visit marketplacemoney.org for more tips on knowing your consumer rights and how to negotiate with bill collectors. And if the collector on the other end isn't as upstanding as Jack, make sure to follow his advice for filing a formal complaint. Years ago, Greg McKenna was heading towards being the kind of guy debt collector Jack Brown is always chasing. He'd fallen on some bad times, had a business go south, and owed a chunk of money. Today, he is debt-free and has a nest egg worth more than $100,000. So how did he do it? Greg wrote into Marketplace Money to share his story, and he joins us now. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Barbara.
Okay, tell us, how did you fall into debt way back when?
I was invited to share in a business opportunity with a college buddy. He was living the life down in the San Diego area, and I quickly fell into that. Trying to keep up with him and that crowd, I got the nice car, I ran up some credit card debt, and very quickly, it seems, I started to feel the pinch.
Yeah, how much did you owe?
Neighborhood of $27,000. Combination of loans and credit card debt.
Okay, so you were living a little high and you owed a bit. How did you pay that off?
Well, after the panic subsided a little bit, I sold the car. I then bought a rust bucket of a Honda and fixed it up so that it was roadworthy. And once that loan was gone, I then applied those former loan payments to my credit card debt.
How has your brush with debt changed you?
Well, in addition to changing my lifestyle, I educated myself. Every time a book was recommended on your show, I made sure to find it at the library. I discussed it with my friends and family whenever we had a chance.
How do you deal with money differently now?
Well, I certainly respect it a lot more. I have regular payments coming out of my paycheck into my savings. I don't get extravagant. I share a car with my current wife. We eliminate the bills we can. We live well within our means.
Why'd you write into Marketplace Money?
I was grateful. I have been a regular listener to the show, and I have taken a lot of advice to heart. You even had a segment once about checking in with your credit score with someone you were just starting to date. And sure enough, I did that on the first date with my lovely wife, Marion.
Really? You checked on her credit score?
Well, I asked about it, and we actually set a date to share our credit information.
Good for you. Well, thanks for that plug. Thanks for listening.
Sure.
Greg McKenna is an arborist in Palo Alto and a Marketplace listener. And Greg, thanks for being a bright spot in our show about debt.
It was my pleasure.
And if you'd like some more information about getting out of debt along the lines of what Greg mentioned, check out our website, marketplacemoney.org. Debt has a new face. It's very young and very worried. This week, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York reports today's average student loan debt is $25,000. Another survey by Fidelity estimates the college class of 2013 will graduate owing more than $35,000 in federal, state, and private loans. And student debt could have a big impact on the broader economy. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says it limits borrowers' willingness to take on new financial obligations, like buying a car or a house or starting a small business. Well, those are the numbers. Now let's get down to the emotions. Having to pay back tens of thousands of dollars after graduation, that can be downright scary.
Did you get my message?
I got it. I don't understand. You've been out of school for over a year. Are you at least saving?
Saving how, Mom? I'm working 55 hours a week. I'm exhausted. I've got tens of thousands of dollars of student loans. I've got my car payment. It's like, what am I supposed to do?
I'm sorry, Kate, but we think it's time you handle this on your own.
I really hope that's not my daughter in a few years. And what is this poor girl supposed to do? Our guest, Betsy Mayotte, has some answers. She's the director of regulatory compliance at the nonprofit organization American Student Assistance. And that clip you just heard is from their new mock horror short film called The Red. It's part of a campaign to raise awareness about the problem of student debt. Betsy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Well, let's take some calls. First up is actually an intern from your organization, Betsy. Your colleague Sasha is calling us from Boston, and Sasha is a 20-year-old senior at Emerson College. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, how are you?
We're great here.
Awesome. Okay, my question is, I'm currently enrolled in college, and I'm looking to start making extra payments to my student loans while I'm in college. And I have both federal and private loans of varying interest rates. And I was wondering how I should go about deciding which loans to start making extra payments towards.
Well, Sasha, Betsy knows your story, but I would like to know a little bit more information. What are you majoring in at Emerson?
I'm majoring in writing, literature, and publishing.
Okay, so you're headed for publishing or perhaps journalism?
Hopefully, yes.
And how much do you owe?
I currently owe $78,000.
Okay, Betsy? I imagine you've had conversations with Sasha before about this.
We have talked about it a little bit, but this is a new question. Now, you know, I'm not a financial planner. You know, Sasha, that I'm a student loan nerd, and that's really where my expertise is. But I do know that a lot of financial planners will suggest a strategy where perhaps you pay the highest interest rate debt down first. That would seem the most logical. Or others have a plan where you start with the smaller debts and add the extra money to the smaller debts. And then as you pay that one off, you add all that extra money to the next debt and so on and so forth. In this case, my personal advice would be to suggest something a little bit different. I would focus on the private loans before adding the extra money to the federal loans. And the reason I say this is because federal student loans have a lot more benefits and options available to them than private student loans do.
What do you mean by benefits and options?
Well, federal student loans have 4, 5, 6, 7, depending on what type of loan you have, lower payment options. By benefits, I mean there are some deferment options where on some of the loans the interest wouldn't even accrue if you had to use one of those deferments. There's also some forgiveness benefits available. For example, Sasha, if you were to continue to work at a nonprofit organization and you worked there for 10 years, it's possible that some of your debt could be forgiven after that 10-year period.
Was that part of your strategy in working for Betsy's organization?
I had no idea about this until I started working for the organization, and then I started learning about all these forgiveness plans, and it's definitely kind of influenced my future career path.
I bet a lot of kids don't know about this, Betsy. Is that right?
I agree. Public service loan forgiveness is fairly new. The reason that Congress put it into place was to make it easier and to encourage people to plan their life knowing that they had this opportunity and didn't have to make the decision between the size of the paycheck versus public service passion.
So, Sasha, does that give you a start?
Yeah, it definitely gives me a start. It was very helpful advice.
Okay. Well, good luck with that journalism plan. And
thank
I hope you.
You
get lots of social media training and programming and some skills under your belt, because I think you might need them. But thanks for calling in.
No problem.
Well, she's certainly at the right job. I would think you would be a very popular place to intern straight out of college.
Well, she's really taking advantage of it, too, as you could see.
Well, I think you have to. I mean, I think it would have been a good thing if financial literacy were in everyone's back pocket way back when. But right now, with this kind of debt burden, I would imagine these kids really need to be up on this information.
Absolutely. And what we tend to see is people with higher student loan debt tend to lean towards what I call the ostrich effect, where they just, oh my God, the number's so big, I'm just going to stick my head in the sand, and they don't try to dig down into it and A, make a plan, and B, find out the details of what that debt consists of.
Well, let's take another call. We have Dylan on the line now from Baltimore. Hi, Dylan. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Well, let's lay down the basics. Where do you go to school and how much do you owe?
Well, I am a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University, and I am in a school counseling program. I have 9 more credits to graduate this summer, and I currently owe about $70,000 in federal loans. I didn't take any private loans, but then I do owe roughly $20,000 to family members.
Right. And I see from your email you owe some to your dad and also to your aunt.
Yeah. So her loan was for about $16,000, and she gave me an interest rate that is comparable to what she would be getting in a savings account.
I also see from reading your email to us that you deferred grad school for a little while.
Right.
Because you had an amazing job, and I think you were probably the most popular person in America.
Yeah. So I graduated in 2011, and I was hired by Oscar Mayer to drive the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile.
I feel like we should hear the song.
Exactly.
Oh, I love to be an Oscar Mayer Wiener. That is what I truly like to be.
You drove the Wienermobile around the country.
Nothing like saying that I deferred my graduate studies at Johns Hopkins to drive a hot dog.
Okay, well, what is your question for Betsy?
So my question is, you know, obviously my father, he's a CPA, a certified public accountant, so he knows his way around a dollar. He's gracious enough, or has been gracious enough to this point, to be paying for my cell phone, for, you know, my car insurance. So how would you suggest, do I start budgeting for those types of expenses that right now I'm not paying? And, you know, my job outlook is pretty good. I've had several interviews, and, you know, he tells me he's going to cut me off, like, as soon as I, you know, have a paycheck.
You've had several interviews to be a school counselor in a public
school counselor. Yeah. So The best part is that I have all the student debt, and then I'm helping students in Baltimore complete their financial aid. It's kind of a cycle, isn't it?
That's great.
Ah, okay. Betsy, what do you think?
Well, I think the first thing you need to do is wrap your arms around what those expenses are, and whether you do that by doing your own research about what those costs would be in Baltimore, which is what I would suggest. There's a lot of great budgeting calculators online. You know, shameless plug, we have one at our website, saltmoney.org. but there's a million of them out there. So I would start off with one of those budgeting calculators. It will help if you've already accepted the position and know what your income is going to be, and that will help you realize, you know, what expenses you can afford. For example, what level of cell phone service you receive could be affected by, you know, your various expenses versus your salary and so on.
Mm-hmm. And Dylan, you were also asking, what do you pay off first, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing is, you know, do I ask my father to carry the cost of my car lease until I have gotten some of my student loan debt paid?
Well, in this situation, because of the career that you're going into, there's a forgiveness program out there. I don't know if you heard me mention it before, called Public Service Loan Forgiveness. And I think it's very likely you may qualify for this. So because of that, I wouldn't necessarily rush to pay extra towards the student loan debt. The way the program works is that if you work for 10 years in a public service aspect, and that could mean police, that could mean fire, that could mean some teachers, nurses, but also any nonprofit, and you make payments while you're working during that 10-year period, and anything that may be left over is forgiven.
You said some teachers. Would Dylan qualify, though, since he'll be a school counselor?
It would depend on where he was working. If he was a school counselor in a public school, then he would qualify because he was working for a public school. It has more to do with who you're working for versus what your position is. If after 10 years you still owe $100,000, they'll forgive $100,000. There is no limit to the forgiveness amount.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, it really sounds like, Dylan, that you need to get up on the specifics of these programs.
Yeah.
And it might guide your job search, too.
Yeah, and my dad's always trying to, he recently emailed me a budget to start using, and, you know, it's still sitting in my email box. So it's probably about time.
It's not going to go away.
Good luck with your loans, and thanks so much for calling in, Dylan.
Thanks, I appreciate your time.
Let's take another call. Nicole is on the line. She's in East Hampton, Massachusetts, and she is the first of her family to graduate from college. And not only that, she's a lawyer. She passed the bar in Massachusetts 4 years ago. Nicole, welcome to the show, and man, well done.
Hello. Thank you very much.
I understand, though, you're in a difficult situation right now financially. Tell us about it.
Correct. I graduated from law school, and I didn't have any work lined up. Boston is notorious for having too many lawyers. So I moved out to Western Mass, I started a solo practice, I got married, and then I had to take a job as a paralegal in order to support my family. So when I was working, I found out actually I have a medical condition that added another $6,000 to my personal debt. And one of the first things I did as an attorney is I filed bankruptcy for myself, but I couldn't get rid of the $250,000 in student debt. It's kind of unreal.
Wow. I'm holding my breath and kind of in shock about that amount of money.
It's totally worth it. I know I've been able to help people since I've graduated, but I can't pay off the loans. I'm in deferment right now, which I have to renew every year.
Okay. Are these private student loans or federal student loans or both?
They're both, but the majority of them is the federal student loan.
Oh, that's great news. So, and are these loans, have any of them ever been in a default status?
Only accidentally they've gone into default for like a month or so. But otherwise,
okay.
They're all in deferment currently.
Okay, that's great news.
Okay, why? Why is this all great news?
There's a program called income-based repayment under the federal student loan program. And I think this is going to help Nicole be able to manage this debt and also see a light at the end of the tunnel. Income-based repayment, what it does is it makes sure that your payment is no more than 15% of your income minus an allowance for your family size. So there's a chart, if you go into any website that talks about income-based repayment, that tells the different amounts that you can subtract for family size. You subtract that from your income, take 15% of it, and that's going to be what your payment amount is. The payment amount is therefore going to follow your income. If your income drops, your payment amount's going to drop. And after 25 years on this program, any remaining balance is forgiven.
You were talking about family size. Betsy, Nicole, you said you got married?
I did. The unfortunate fact is I got married, and I'm actually getting divorced right now because of some of the financial situations and the fact that I wanted to have children. And I had an argument with my husband that we'd never be able to afford it, much less a house to keep them in or like saving for them to go to college or any of this because of how long it would take me to pay off my debt. I want to try and save so I can have my life happen. while I'm paying off my student loans, but I'm very confused. I'm in this holding pattern that I can't do anything with my life other than try and find a job. And when I find a job, I'll still be stuck like this because I'll just be paying off my loans.
Oh, Nicole, I really feel for you. Betsy, what are your thoughts?
Well, there's a bunch of other lower payment options, and I think at this point it's a matter of finding the one that fits her budget. Have you consolidated your federal student loans yet to extend the term?
Yes.
Okay, that's a good start. There's a plan called graduated repayment where essentially you start off at interest only and then the payment gradually goes up. You may want to look at a calculator to see what that payment would be, to see if it's something you could afford now. And then maybe once you've been able to take a chunk out of that extra medical bill, that income-based repayment might be a better fit for you down the road.
Okay.
There's a plan similar to income-based repayment, and they're not very creative with these names, so it can get confusing. Income contingent repayment. The formula for that is very different. It's a little more complicated, but some borrowers actually end up with a lower payment under income contingent repayment than they would under income-based repayment. So you should definitely ask your loan holder about that as well. You want to try to satisfy the interest that's accruing every month, so at least the debt's not getting any bigger.
Do you have any, like, recommendations for how I should save for, like, a personal safety net while I'm in deferment?
They always say to pay yourself first, so make sure you've itemized your budget, every single thing. The gas tank, the grocery bill, the iced coffees every morning, that sort of thing. And then figure out how much you can afford to save and just make sure that you pay yourself first.
Right.
Nicole, I wish better times for you, and I can really hear that you're trying.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling in. Oh, Betsy, that is just so sad.
Well, the unfortunate thing, I mean, that large of a student loan debt is actually not as common as some might read in the newspapers. It's been kind of a big story lately. But it, as we can see with Nicole, it certainly does exist. It's always the same story, is that I want to pay, but here's my situation and how do I handle it? And again, I always go back to just always pick up the phone and call and find out what options are available to you. And don't just think about the next couple months. Try to come up with a plan such as income-based repayment or public service loan forgiveness or graduated repayment that will actually work with you over the next 10 years and grow with your lifestyle.
Well, Nicole is so crunched. I wonder how college-age kids should think about these numbers, what college and graduate school cost in order to figure out how much student loan debt they can afford to take on.
I get asked all the time, what's the right amount of student debt? And I don't think there's a real answer to that. I think there's too many variables. But if I was forced to make it simple, there's a lot of people that say you should look at what the average starting salary is for the career that you're studying for and try not to borrow more than what that annual salary is.
Well, we have so many more questions, but we'll be coming back to this issue. That's for sure. Betsy Mayotte is the Director of Regulatory Compliance at the nonprofit organization American Student Assistance. And Betsy, thank you so much for the advice today.
Thanks for having me.
And we have a web extra for you. You can find out how bad student debt is in your state. We have debt maps at our website, marketplacemoney.org. Before we all get too worked up about student loan debt, here's a bit of perspective from commentator Chris Farrell.
Paying for college has practically become synonymous with financial ruin. We've all heard the stories of graduates toiling at minimum wage jobs weighed down by student loan debt. That's given rise to a new strand of conventional wisdom that warns young people to steer clear of borrowing for college. The message? College isn't worth it. You don't want to join the ranks of debt slaves with a diploma. Hold on a minute. We know few students these days can afford college without borrowing some money. The average student loan balance is about $24,000, according to a report from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That's an onerous sum for newly minted college graduates in a lousy economy, but it's far from catastrophic. Throughout our history, the American dream has often come with a loan repayment schedule. In 1620, the Pilgrims were able to settle in Plymouth, Massachusetts, only because they were backed by London merchant bankers. They eventually bought out their investors, paying off their debt in installments. My fear is that the student loan scare stories will persuade young people to avoid college, especially those from low-income families. Bottom line, college remains the best investment most people will ever make. Case in point, college graduates earn some 50% more than their peers with only a high school diploma. Don't get me wrong. The financial aid system cries out for reform. Many college graduates are hurting, and tragically, some have borrowed more than they can ever repay. However, for most, the student loan debts will eventually pay off in good jobs. So please, borrow sensibly. Go to a college you can afford. Avoid private student loans. Take out as few federal student loans as possible. And by all means, remember the Pilgrims.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Barbara Bogave. When you're in debt, one of the worst choices you can make is to take on more debt to pay your creditors, especially if it's at high interest. But that's exactly the kind of financial hole many people dig themselves into, particularly men and women serving in the military. This is such a problem that in 2007, the Department of Defense started enforcing something called the Military Lending Act to protect troops from predatory lenders. But plenty of financially stressed troops are still falling prey to them. Mitchell Hartman from the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk has been looking into this. He's produced a series of reports in collaboration with ProPublica. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Barbara. It's good to be here.
Well, here's what I don't understand right off the bat. How could all these predatory lenders still be targeting soldiers when this Military Lending Act was designed precisely to ban this kind of activity?
Well, there's money to be made. And so lenders jump in to try to make that money. Military families have a regular paycheck. They're not paid all that much. They have emergencies just like everybody, you know, and then they get deployed and they can't deal with them. So they go for quick cash, even if it costs a fair amount to get that cash. Now, it is true the Military Lending Act banned in particular short-term loans, so payday loans, car title loans, and it set an interest cap of 36%. Problem is, lenders have figured out ways to get around that. They're doing it legally, but what they're doing is they're lending at longer terms, so more than 6 months, more than a year, still backed by a car maybe, and the car may be lost if the military borrower doesn't pay up. But in the end, those are legal, and families and soldiers are getting dragged into them.
I see. So they're finding loopholes. So how creative are they getting with these loans? And can you give us an example of a military family who's fallen for this predatory loan?
Yeah. I went to Hinesville, Georgia. It's outside Savannah. It's the home of Fort Stewart Army Base. So I met a family, Mark and Lisa Gerber. They got in trouble because they had a base transfer. They owned a house. They couldn't sell the house. They couldn't rent the house, headed into foreclosure. They're trying desperately to borrow money to pay that mortgage. They did a military installment loan, pretty high interest. Then they fell for an internet loan that turned out to be fraudulent. They got another loan. In the end, they got foreclosed, lost their house, lost their car. Now they're in rental housing and just trying to make ends meet with a bankruptcy on their record.
It sounds like they needed some kind of financial literacy counseling.
Well, yeah, and the Army offers a lot of that. They really push it. They push it on officers because officers often end up dealing with this when soldiers get behind on these payments. The guy at the loan store picks up the phone and calls the base and calls the commanding officer. It affects readiness of the troops. It affects morale. They don't want this to happen. They also, interestingly enough, offer zero interest emergency loans for just such a situation. The problem is military members don't often want to take them. There's a lot of strings attached. It is going through the chain of command. You know, your boss is approving the loan. Here's Mark Gerber. He explains.
I've used the Army Emergency Relief. We were in Hurricane Rita quite a few years ago, and with the power outage, all the branches of our bank in Mississippi were destroyed. So even though the Army was paying us, it was a time where I wasn't getting any money, and it helped out a lot.
But look, you know, it's not perfect. Lisa, his wife, jumped in.
They helped pay a month's worth of bills, and they gave us one big giant check. for the groceries that you could only spend at the commissary, but it was only one check. You couldn't get change back or nothing. And I'm like, I can't have milk for a month in the refrigerator and bread for a month.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like such a great deal.
No. And, you know, as several people told me, you know, look, they don't want their boss in their business. This is going to the man. I don't know about you, but I don't want to go to my boss and say, gee, I need money till the end of the month. Can you please advance it to me?
No, now I get it. That's completely understandable. But do you see any broader reform of high interest lending coming out of this?
Definitely. First of all, the military is looking at this. You know, they also know that this is a problem. They've been looking into it with the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. They're going to be writing new regulations. What's interesting is that there are members of Congress who would actually like to see the kinds of limits on interest that now apply to the military, this 36% rate cap, extended to the whole country. Senator Dick Durbin introduced a bill. It would set that limit for all consumer finance across the country. Their argument basically is lenders should be able to make a decent living off of 36% interest. If it's good enough for the military, it's good enough for the rest of us.
Mitchell Hartman, he's with the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk. His series, Beyond Payday Loans, was produced in collaboration with ProPublica. And Mitchell, thanks for this.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
And be sure to check out the entire series on payday lending, including a behind-the-scenes podcast about Mitchell's reporting, at marketplace.org. Earlier this hour, we gave some advice on paying off student loans. And one line of thought on college loans is that graduating with a manageable amount of debt can be a good thing. It's an incentive to make a budget and stick to it, and it gives young people a sense of responsibility. In other words, going into debt can have some positive outcomes, as impossible as that seems, even if you aren't a student. Facing your financial mistakes can strengthen your relationships or teach you better habits. We have some listeners on the line now who have stories along these lines, and we're also joined by financial advisor Liz Weston to talk about possible silver linings of borrowing from and lending money to people important to us. Liz, welcome back to Marketplace Money.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, we've been asking our listeners, as I just said, to tell us about how borrowing or lending money has affected their personal relationships, and it's no surprise. Most of them say that being on either end of debt has led to some problems. What is your policy on borrowing or lending money to family members and friends?
Well, I've done it, and I do it with trepidation. I've been fortunate economically basically ever since I started working, and other members of my family have not been there. So when they've been in need, you know, we've stepped up when we could, which is when we usually can.
Did you put things down on paper?
It has never been a loan because I don't believe in lending money. I think because most of the time loans turn into gifts anyway. So
why not gift outright from the start?
Yeah, exactly. And I've also said no. There was one case where a family member was heading to bankruptcy and we could have written a check to keep her out of it. But we could see by the way she was going to wind up in bankruptcy anyway.
So it would have just been a finger in the dike.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's really tough to say no to someone who has asked you for help.
So it sounds like it depends on the situation.
All the time. And almost everything that has to do with money is situational.
Well, okay. With that in mind, we have a couple of listeners on the line who are willing to share their stories about debt and relationships with us. Maggie in Beaverton, Oregon. Welcome to the show, Maggie.
Thank you very much.
So you want to talk about how to pay off what you owe while you also are saving up for a family. Is that right?
Yes, my husband and I have a considerable amount of debt, and we've also been hoping to start a family for almost 10 years now, and the two are not reconciling very well.
What kind of debt are we talking about here?
Well, combined, we owe about $50,000 in student loan debt.
Wow, and you borrowed some money from your parents.
We have borrowed money from my parents for a couple different things, emergencies, taxes, and a down payment on our home that we purchased about 10 years ago.
What are the terms of the loan from your parents?
Well, my parents are amazing people. They've been very generous.
So they're parental terms, right?
Yeah, they pretty much gifted us the money, but my husband and I consider it a loan. And we drew up papers and we've made monthly payments for quite a while.
And has being in debt to your family changed your relationship with them at all?
they spend their whole lives saving money. And for me, it makes me feel worried that I can't do enough to thank them.
So it weighs on you.
Yeah.
What about the burden of debt and its effect on your marriage?
We have both experienced extreme stress about the money we owe and our career choices and how much risk we can take. My husband started a business a few years ago, and just last year it just ended, and we've taken on the business debt as well, and I worry.
Yeah, sure. Liz, what are your thoughts?
Maggie, you're a teacher. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes.
Okay, and what was your business that your husband was in?
He is a remodeler.
Okay, and how old are you two?
37.
Okay, so the issue of having a family, you're getting down to the wire at this point.
We are.
Okay. Were you thinking of adoption? Were you thinking of fertility treatments?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
We've kind of done a little bit of research into both adoption and fertility.
Okay.
After having one miscarriage, I backed off of the fertility a little bit, mm-hmm. and we pursued the adoption a little more. But we realized with both that it's going to be an investment of money that we don't have right now, and yeah. we don't know what to do about that because time is ticking by.
Yeah. Oh, you're in a tight spot. I won't downplay that at all. But I will say, are the student loans, are those all federal student loans?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm so glad to hear that, because federal student loan debt is probably the most flexible debt you can have. And I know it weighs on you, and you look at those 6.8% or whatever it is, interest rates, and writhe, you know, because you know that people are getting 0% for credit cards and very low rates. But actually, that federal student loan debt is as flexible as you can get. And you might look into, if you haven't already, maybe an income-based repayment program.
Something we've heard a lot about yeah. on this program so far okay. this hour.
I know that people rush and really want to get this debt paid off, but in this case, you might look at trying to get that nut down so that you can concentrate on some of the other issues, because it sounds like that business issue is really hanging over your head.
Yeah.
Is the business debt, is that credit cards, or what? In what form is that debt?
Unpaid taxes and credit card debt.
The IRS does not like to be owed money. They are pretty strict about that. That rises to the top, definitely. And with the credit cards, it might be an option for settlement or something else.
Mm-hmm.
I know that bankruptcy is not the first thing on anyone's mind, and we didn't talk about how much you owe, so maybe I should ask that.
Taking out the mortgage, that's about $180,000.
Maggie, I hate to say this, but you might want to explore the possibility of bankruptcy. I know that's a huge step, but when people get into this much debt, especially with business debt, it's really hard to dig your way out. At least talk to a bankruptcy attorney about what your options are. Might not be the best choice, and it won't get rid of the student loan debts. Those will still be there. And if you decide later to pay some of these debts, you always can. But what you're facing now is the issue where this is big enough debt, you could get sued over it. You know, you could wind up with wage garnishments. There are some ugly things that could happen with that much debt hanging over you.
Maggie, okay. I wish you luck. Thanks for calling
Thank you.
In.
Thanks for the advice.
Well, good luck, Maggie.
Bye.
Well, we have another caller. Jeff is in San Francisco, and he is one of our Facebook friends. And he wrote to us about rekindling a relationship with an ex whom he separated from because of money issues. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks. Long-time listener, first-time caller. So I always wanted to use the line.
There you
even
go.
Practicing that. Tell us about this former fiancé of yours. I understand you two had very different approaches to money at the start of your relationship.
Well, when we started dating, she had a good job. She left that job because she felt that it just wasn't her calling. She became a massage therapist. Had some time in between those careers and accumulated quite a hefty amount of debt, so much so that it was insurmountable. She filed bankruptcy, and several years later, after where she could start getting credit, I put her on my credit cards, and we said we got a joint card so we could start rebuilding her credit. But what really came down to is we just had different beliefs about money. She felt money wasn't important. I felt money was important, whether it's retirement and looking and saving for future or accidents or any of the number of things that life's maladies can bring your way sometimes.
Pretty big differences there. How much did you guys fight about money?
Well, it wasn't so much about fight as every time I would bring up money and discuss about like trying to set her with a budget. She would tell me I was parenting her about money, and it was one of the stressors that ended up separating. And after we did that, she had to fully be independent. And that was one of my, I was like, it's just going to be difficult. And you need to kind of start figuring out, you really need to develop a relationship with your money. And she ended up doing a massage on the gentleman who writes the Millionaire Mindset series.
There you go. Serendipity.
So just giving them the guy a massage. He's like, you should really go and check this out. We have a free seminar in Sacramento for 4 days. So anytime I hear seminar free 4 days, I was like, well, it's a cult, but it could be a good cult for you. I'm not really sure. So day four, she texts me. She's like, money is important. It was like, you know, the clouds parted and the beams of sunlight came down. Like,
she did a 180 on you.
She started saving, and, you know, I pay her health care and the deposit on the house.
And you two started seeing each other again, right?
Yeah, we started dating again, so that's been nice.
Are you on a track to marriage?
No, let's not get that far ahead of ourselves.
Okay. That was a question for Liz. But I wonder whether this is a true turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
For your ex-fiancé, Jeff, and what Jeff should be on the lookout for.
How old are you guys?
I'm 41 and she is 44.
Okay. Here's the thing, Jeff. When you're good with money, you can come off like a parent in a relationship. And that's just
sure.
The burden that we have because, you know, we know how to do this and we know that you should do it our way and we can come across really overbearing. And the other thing is, we are not always right. Shocking, but it took me a while of marriage to realize that my artist husband also had a pretty good perspective. You know, he came from a different background. He had different ideas. And one of the great things about marriage and a committed relationship is you get to work these things out. And, you know, we always joke that if it were up to me, we would still be sitting on orange crates in our living room. We'd have the house, but no furniture. If it were up to him, we wouldn't have a retirement fund. So, you know, somewhere in between is a nice middle path. And I would say it sounds like your girlfriend had a revelation. She really did have an epiphany. So my focus in this situation would be to be on myself and make sure that I'm not the parent and make sure that I'm not the one dictating the terms, as it were. One of the best things to do as a couple is simply talk about what are your first memories about money? How did they handle money in your family?
Oh, that'll open up a long conversation.
Oh, my gosh. So many discussions that you can have. But this is a process of rebuilding. You guys broke up. You're coming back together. There's going to be a lot of discussions about that. And, you know, the short answer to your question, Jeff, is, you know, there really is no way to know. She could hide things from you if she wanted to. She's got her own life.
It's like so much in marriage.
Yes, exactly.
I hope this helps you out, at least gives you something to think about.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much. You guys have a great weekend.
You too. Liz, it's so great having you here. That's all the time we have for our callers today.
It was great to be here, Barbara. Thanks for asking me.
Well, we hope you've come away from our show on debt with some helpful advice and gotten to know some new music as well. This hour, we played some of our favorite songs about debt, but we couldn't fit them all in. So we've created a Spotify playlist for you at marketplacemoney.org. Here's a sample. So many songs to choose from. One of my favorites is Busted by Ray Charles. What's yours? If there's a song about owing money that you think should be added to the list, just let us know at marketplacemoney.org. That wraps it up for this week. You know you can reach us on our website, or you can get in touch on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, the lengths people go to in a tough economy.
Right now, I live with my dad. I lost a job, so I was forced to move back in with him. There's some benefits to it. I don't pay rent, but I live in the living room.
Marketplace Money is produced this week by Devin Maverick Robbins with Lindsay Foster Thomas, Daryl Paranada, and Margaret Airy. Chris Clark is our engineer. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Barbara Bogave. I've really enjoyed spending the past few months with you. Thanks for talking money with me. And be sure to listen in for guest host Adrian Hill at the mic next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.